Blog Talk Radio.
Silvio Canto in Dallas, Texas, on Saturday, September the 20th, day number 263 of 2014. Today we're going to continue our series of programs with Barry Jacobson about World War One. We're up to Chapter 7, and tonight we're going to be looking at the aftermath. You know, the war is finally ending, and now you got to put the pieces back together, you got to draw the boundaries, and everybody has to, the winners, I guess, decide what the boundaries are. So we're going to get into a lot of that tonight. A lot of the consequences of World War One were felt 20 years later in World War Two, and then, of course, they continue to be felt today, as I'm sure Barry will explain when we talk about the boundaries that came about because of World War One. You know, if you enjoy listening to audiobooks, a lot of people do. I happen to be one of them. If you enjoy listening to audiobooks, you drive around, you are here, going there, and you enjoy putting an audiobook, it used to be your cassette player. Now, then it became, a CD. Now you put it right in your phone, whatever it may be. Check out our friends at Audible.com. It's an Amazon company, and you can go there and check out their inventory. They have a relationship with Blog Talk Radio. And I tell you, they've got some great inventory at Audible.com. If you go to Audible.com, if you get yourself a book, and I assure you, I hope you do, you're going to make my day. You're going to make my week. You're going to make you're going to make my life. Well, you can make my day at least. So check out Audible.com. We have a link on the website. We're going to take a break, and we've got Barry right after this. Silvio Canto in Dallas, Texas, and I'm going to say something that I think Barry will appreciate because he and I have a similar taste in movies. But let's say hello to Barry. How are you?
I am much better today than I was when I spoke to you on Thursday. That's for sure.
I think you certainly sound a lot better, but I think you'll appreciate what I'm about to say. You know, here on a Saturday afternoon, as I'm getting ready to do the show with you, I have on TV a John Wayne movie, and they're going through the credits, who's on the movie, who's in the movie. They got John Wayne, they got Dean Martin, they got Rick Nelson, of all people, Ricky Nelson. But then they have
Real
Angie,
Bravo, right?
Yeah, that's right. But then they come up to Angie Dickinson, and I say, now there is my favorite character of that movie.
Well, you know, that movie, Real Bravo, is one of my favorites. It was remade virtually line for line as Rio Lobo a little bit later, a few years later, with a slightly different cast, Robert Mitchum replacing Dean Martin, James Caan replacing Ricky Nelson.
Ricky Nelson,
I can't remember. I can't remember who replaced Walter Brennan. It had just a tremendous cast, didn't it?
Well, when they said Angie Dickinson, I said, that's it. That's the best one.
Are you a fan?
I like the movie. I love the movie, but I definitely do like Angie Dickinson. I think wasn't she police woman also?
I was about to ask. Is that when you became a fan? Is on Police Woman?
Actually, I didn't. That show, I didn't. I guess it was okay, but she does have a great role in this movie, Real Bravo. I mean, she really stands out. if I don't mean to say her acting, I mean, it's just that she's a good-looking girl. I mean, let's just say she looks real good in the midst of all these cowboys in that movie, Barry.
Well, and when you have a mug like John Wayne's and Robert Mitchum's, it's not difficult to look good.
No, not at all.
You know, by comparison.
That's right. But anyway, I just saw those credits just as we were going on the little break there, and I said I'm going to mention this because I know Barry Jacobson is going to appreciate Angie Dickinson. I mean, who wouldn't, right?
Well, she's not my favorite actress of that period, but she definitely has some charm and intelligence and a lot of sass. My favorite actress of that period was probably either Ava Gardner or Kim Novak. Those are the ones that really did it for me.
Well, Anne Margaret was in that time frame too, wasn't she?
She sure was. Yeah, early 60s.
Yeah, she was in that time frame. I think, in fact, she may have been in one of John Wayne's movies. Certainly a couple of Elvis movies, but I don't remember John Wayne. But anyway, let's talk about World War One. And I want to begin today with On This Day in History. You know, letters are always a big part of war. The soldiers writing home, that's a big part of the history of any war. And on this day in 1918, that would have been toward the end of the war, a young officer, George S. Patton, wrote a letter to his family telling his mom and dad about, you know, what he was going through in some of the battles. He was serving under General MacArthur. I thought that was interesting. And I wanted to bring this up, Barry, for no other reason than to show, of course, some of the personalities of that war, but to connect World War One with subsequent World War Two, and even today. I mean, MacArthur and Patton are generals that we talk about all the time. So there they were back in World War One.
Yes, they were. Patton, in that same letter to his father, makes some comment about the fear of raising his face above the parapet during a firefight, during a machine gunning, when, you know, their bullets are flying around, and he was a new soldier on the front. And he said, once you get your head up, it was sort of like diving in a cold swimming pool. You know, you got used to it pretty quick.
Yes, yeah, it is really a neat letter. And I'm going to post it on, I'm going to post the letter on Facebook later tonight with a link to the show that we're doing now. But I just thought it was really cool, and we talked a little bit about this in one of our previous shows, and we will more either today or the next show, about these personalities that just went, you know, from one war to the other, in different roles, obviously, but nevertheless names that, you know, we heard about. I mean, MacArthur, obviously, one of the great generals. And, of course, MacArthur was also involved in another serious incident when he was basically let go by President Truman over the Korean War. And Patton was also a controversial fellow, too, in World War II. There was an incident with a young soldier that became very famous. So these were two pretty interesting guys, Barry.
Can I say one more thing about George Patton at that very young age? Patton... he was the consummate warrior, even more probably than MacArthur, who was quite a soldier in his own right. To overcome his fear of being shot at, Patton, when he was at West Point, he would go down to the shooting range. He had a rifle range. And in those days, to make a target pop up and down, you had to have somebody actually in a pit behind the target, raising and lowering it, raising the target, lowering it, and then they'd actually take off the paper target when it was shot full of holes and replace it with new paper. Well, one time when he was, or several times when he was doing that duty down in the rifle pit, changing the targets and moving the targets, young George Patton would stand up deliberately with his face above the edge of the trench while the bullets were flying, just to force himself to overcome the fear of being shot.
Amazing. Amazing. You know, it's interesting how some guys become great soldiers, and it's like any other profession, I guess. You know, some guys become great architects, engineers, or whatever. In your opinion, what makes a great soldier? Before we get to our topic, you know, what makes a great soldier? You write so much about war and about battles. So what are some of the qualities that makes a great soldier, Barry?
Well, you sort of already hinted at it when you said that there are great soldiers, they're also great architects, they're great musicians. Very much like any of those other professions, you can be a really good musician with study under the right teachers. And if you apply yourself, you can be a very good musician. But to be a great musician, to be a Mozart, takes a sort of an innate genius that you're born with. And it's that way with war. There are military geniuses that surpass just good generals or good soldiers and really rise to the level of true genius. And it seems so maybe brutal to think of war as a realm of genius. But there really is an art to war. There's an art to command. And some men are born with that. Some men become, like the U.S. Army trains officers at West Point and other places, and we turn out a very good crop of leaders, but the true geniuses are born that way. And it's just a gift they have.
Mm-hmm. But it doesn't necessarily mean, because I think there's a misunderstanding, or at least I think there is a misunderstanding, correct me if I'm wrong, but there's a misunderstanding that people who are great soldiers like war in the sense they like to see people get killed. I think they understand, my thinking is they understand the need for war. They don't necessarily like people being killed, but they make the best of it in winning the battle and protecting their men. That's sort of my definition, Barry.
Yeah, that's certainly an element, and it's particularly an element in modern Western society, which, due to our Christian, Judeo-Christian roots, has a strong concept, a strong background in the concept of just war, and where war has a moral place, generally combating evil and defending itself. But you know, what most great soldiers, and most professional soldiers for that matter, not even great ones, just most professional soldiers, enjoy about war, if you can say enjoy, is it's a form of competition at the very highest level in human society. No football game, no soccer game has the stakes that a war does, that a battle does. And for the same reason those games are thrilling when you win or lose, the same is with war. You know, it's putting yourself in every essence of your being at stake. Your life,
right.
You know, your reputation, everything, your nation's survival is at stake. And
right.
That's a competition that many men love to rise to, and they thrive in.
Well, and as you indicated, very often your country, your way of life is what's at stake. I mean, certainly I think that's the case in this battle with ISIS that we've talked about. I mean, this is a real clash of cultures and civilizations that the people that want to defeat us have very different ideas than we have with regard to many issues. Well, let's get into our topic, because we have a wonderful topic tonight. We're at the end, pretty much the end of the war, aren't we, Barry? I mean, it's 1918. We're in the fall of 1918 right now. Officer Patton is writing a letter to his parents, and they're trying to put this post-war world together, Barry. So why don't you take it away and lead us in your presentation?
Yes, well, thank you. The guns of August that started sounding in August of 1914, just over 100 years ago, finally came to a close and were silent on the 11th hour, the 11th day of the 11th month, which is to say 11 a.m. on November 11th, 1918, with the armistice that ended World War One. It would be another many months. It would be not until June 28th, actually, in 1919, when the Treaty of Versailles was finally signed, the treaty that created the post-war environment and established the terms of the peace. By the way, that date, June 28th, was deliberately chosen as the day, the anniversary 5 years later, of when the Archduke Frederick Ferdinand had been shot by the assassin in Sarajevo. That began World War One, and set everything in motion. So it was 5 years later they signed the Treaty of Versailles. And one of the delegates of the Treaty of Versailles was the famous economist John Maynard Keynes, as in Keynesian economics. which I know you and I, neither one of us subscribe to that.
No.
I'm more of a Milton Friedman guy.
Right, me too, yeah.
But Keynes was a very influential economist, and he was the British delegate for the Treasury Department at the Treaty of Versailles. And he actually left. He actually resigned and left the conference when he in disgust, when he realized that his counsel would not be heeded. His counsel was basically they were making the treaty was going to be too harsh economically on Germany. He called it a Carthaginian peace, which is to say a peace that is so so onerous that it cripples the other guy and prepares for the next war, creates such hostility and resentment that the defeated power has no option but to go to war again to reverse it. And Woodrow Wilson was at the conference, of course, representing the United States, President Wilson, as was George Clemenceau of France and Lloyd George of England. And they all had their own agenda. Britain wanted Germany restored fairly quickly on its feet so it could become a trading power. But Lloyd George didn't want Germany to have his empire anymore or to be able to compete with the British Empire. So Britain's interest was to have Germany stripped of its foreign colonial territories, which it was. Britain got much of Africa that had belonged to Germany. It already had its own substantial German empire, but now it included much of the German empire as well that had been in Africa. Belgium also got territories, the Congo, Rwanda, Burundi. Those all became Belgian as kind of payment for Belgium being overrun by the Germans. Even Portugal was enlarged a little bit at Germany's expense in Africa. Japan, which had come in very late in the war, sort of as a scavenger to pick the dead German carcass in the Pacific. Basically, Japan got the Solomon and Carolinas from Germany. These were islands that Japan would later use as naval bases and military bases, which we would have to fight over during World War II. You know, the battles of Saipan, for instance, was fought in the Solomon Islands, the Carolinas. Guadalcanal was in the Solomons. These were all given to Japan after World War I by the Treaty of Versailles. So that was Britain's main interest, but it wanted Germany not to be crippled. It wanted Germany to basically be restored economically as a trading partner. France, on the other hand, was not quite so forgiving. France had lost a lot. It then lost the most casualties. We'll talk about casualties in just a minute. But France wanted Germany militarily hamstrung. And they wanted basically a reversal that Germany had gained from France during the Franco-Prussian War of 1870, which is to say it wanted Alsace-Lorraine back, and it did get it back. That's the easternmost part of France that borders the Rhine. And also it ended up occupying the Saar and the Ruhr regions. Basically, the economic industrial heartland of Western Germany was occupied by French troops. And a very stiff reparation was placed on Germany. Reparations mean it had to pay an indemnity. And by the way, one of the things that was most resented by the Germans was Article 231 of the treaty, which came to be known as the guilt clause, the word guilt clause. That basically Germany was blamed and had to accept responsibility for everything that had happened in the war. All the evils of the war were blamed on Germany. While the Ottoman Empire lost its empire and Austria was basically dismembered, we'll talk about that in a moment, the cost of the war was really borne by the Germans. And really unfairly, Germany had not started the war. Germany had gotten into the war after Russia and Austria had gone to war. But it had invaded Belgium, violated Belgian neutrality, and it had Tromps all over northern France, and France wanted revenge. And more importantly, France wanted Germany never to be a threat again. They wanted to rebalance the power in Europe so that France would always have an advantage. So it wanted Germany dismembered and wanted Germany crippled. And it did this by occupying their industrial heartland and imposing a indemnity of about 132 billion marks, which we paid over a period of time. In modern dollars, that equals about $442 billion today. We which even, you know, in today's economy, is that even that's not that much. You know, we spend more than that every year in deficit, in fact. But in those days, that was a lot of money. You know, a dollar meant a lot of money back then. And to pay off this debt, Germany's Weimar Republic, which had replaced the Kaiser in 1918, had to print money. It printed money at such a rate, Germany then went into a period of what we call hyperinflation, where a Deutschmark was worth nothing. In fact, the exchange rate was, are you ready for this? 4 trillion Deutschmarks to the dollar.
Wow. I mean, you've heard, I've heard stories that people would take like a cart and fill it up with paper.
That's right.
It, yeah, I mean, it was just unbelievable.
Just to go shopping. I mean,
just to go shopping, yeah.
Take a wheelbarrow cart full of Deutschmarks.
Yeah.
Kind
of hard to run an economy that way.
Well, it was impossible. And the Weimar Republic had other problems as well. It had radicalism springing up all over the place in the form of communists who were trying to take over. We talked a little bit about that in one of the past shows. But also, particularly in Bavaria, there was groups of returning veterans who formed various groups that were called the Free Corps. And these Free Corps battled the communists in the streets, and eventually the Free Corps developed into political parties. The most prominent of those in Bavaria was the National Socialist Workers' Party, also known as the Nazis. And a returning veteran who had been a corporal and a runner during the war joined them. He was like the 55th member of the party to join, and that was Adolf Hitler. And he very quickly rose to prominence because he, as at that early stage, was their most gifted speaker. He had a real knack for public speaking, as we all know now.
Right.
And it would only be a matter of years before he took over the party entirely and became its absolute leader. So the Weimar Republic had lots of problems in Germany. Now, let's skip for a second. We'll get to more of Germany in just a minute. Let's skip over to Austro-Hungary, because what happened there created a lot of the problems we have to this very day. The Balkans, that territory, that peninsula that's bounded by the Black Sea on one side and the Adriatic Sea on the other, Greece in the south and in Austria and Poland in the north, that whole section is called the Balkans. It had been part of the Austro-Hungarian Empire in the north and the Turkish Empire in the south. After World War I, both those empires were dismantled. Austria was a tiny state now, surrounding basically Vienna in the north and bounded and bordering Germany and Czechoslovakia. Its northeastern territory has been carved out into a brand new nation called Czechoslovakia, which was Bohemia and the Sudetenland taken away from Germany, and Slovakia taken away from Austria, and North Silesia taken from Germany and Austria and given to Poland, which was a new nation as well. Poland had not been a nation since partition in the 18th century by Catherine the Great and Frederick the Great of Prussia, Catherine the Great of Russia. It had briefly been a nation under Napoleon, as an ally of Napoleon's, but then it reverted back to control of Russia. Now it was an independent nation, bounding Germany on one side and Russia on the other. Rather an uncomfortable position for Poland to be in. But in the Balkans, Austro-Hungary had lost Hungary. Hungary had become a separate nation. And Serbia had been rewarded by being given as basically a nation called Yugoslavia, which took in Bosnia, Herzegovina, and Croatia, and Slovakia, and joined them to, and joined them to a nation called Yugoslavia with its own king, and dominated by the Serbians. So, and then Bulgaria was already a separate country. So, Austria was basically no longer a great power. It lost its empire entirely. Poland was a new nation. And in creating Poland and Czechoslovakia, Germany had been affronted by losing again Sudetenland filled with Germans and that was now part of Czechoslovakia. And it lost the area around Danzig, which was a port on the Baltic Sea, which was given to Poland as it would have an access to the sea. It wouldn't be landlocked, because the north of Poland was the area known as East Prussia, which was part of Germany. So by creating the Danzig Corridor, it was called, where Poland was joined to the sea at Danzig, East Prussia got separated from the rest of Germany and became essentially an island surrounded by Poland.
Yeah. One quick thing I wanted to say, I didn't want to break your delivery there, but I just wanted a couple of notes that I made to myself here as I was going along. I think one of the lessons maybe the Allies didn't learn or didn't exercise right after World War One is that, you know, when you win, you want your enemy to be punished, I guess, to a point. But if you punish him too much or you go overboard, maybe that's not a good thing.
That's what Keynes was trying to say when he called it a Carthaginian peace.
That's right.
You don't want to drive your enemy to despair.
Right. And so you don't want to, you want him to surrender, but you don't want to humiliate him on a personal level so that he basically loses all his dignity. And I thought it was interesting, not to change topics, but, you know, when the Germans surrendered in World War II and the Japanese surrendered as well, you didn't see that. There was a certain sense of, okay, guys, you lost. We don't like you. You lost. But we're not going to humiliate you in front of your own people, as I think was done to Germany after World War One, Barry. That's kind of my sense of it. Is that about right?
That's exactly right. And we learned from that. In fact, the United States had been against a lot of those harshest of terms. But we were overruled by both Britain and France in that. Wilson came to the conference with 14 points. He really wanted to see more ethnic self-determination throughout Europe, and he got that in the Balkans. Now, he also got that, by the way, in the Ottoman Empire. He basically drew the map of Armenia, creating a new Armenian state out of the Ottoman Empire, and a Kurdish state. It was supposed to be a Kurdish state as well. But after the war, go ahead.
No, I was go ahead and finish that thought, because I had a question about Wilson, but go ahead and finish what you were saying.
Well, I mean, we're going to get to the Middle East in a little bit, but Wilson drew up, various places, but he didn't get the main thing he wanted, which was softer terms towards Germany.
Right.
And particularly, he didn't get Americans' involvement in the League of Nations.
Right.
And one of the reasons he didn't do that is because the Senate was controlled by the Republicans. And Wilson, much like President Obama today, pretty much went out of his way to alienate the Republicans. Not a single Republican delegate was taken to the conference. So there was no Republican buy-in to the treaty.
Right.
Which he then had to get ratified by the Republican Senate. And
right, sort of like we won, sort of, like Obama's attitude in 2009. Hey, we won the election. Let us run things, yeah? That's how you get Obamacare, the one-party legislation, you know? But
if the election has elections have consequences, sort of attitude.
Yeah, they do. A smart leader knows that you're always better off having somebody from the other side with you, just in case it goes wrong. You don't own it 100%, as Obama owns Obamacare, and probably Wilson owned the League of Nations.
That's right. Exactly. That's a great analogy.
Yeah. Let me make a quick point about Woodrow Wilson, and then we'll get back to our story. As some of the listeners may know, and I'm sure you know this, Barry, that Woodrow Wilson suffered a stroke, and according to some people, he was bedridden for much of his last couple of years, and the famous stories about the First Lady was sort of the gatekeeper to Woodrow Wilson, that kind of thing. This happened after he went to Europe, right? Not before. So when he was in Europe, he was medically okay, or he was in good health. It was after he came back from Europe where I believe he worked himself so hard. Of course, it was a difficult trip, too. I mean, those were different days. And it was in that trip in Europe, he was working so hard and all of that, didn't get enough rest, and as a consequence, when he came back, he suffered that stroke that we talk about. So this was after the league, after Europe, right?
After Europe, and after he tried to get the treaty signed in the Senate, and he failed. I think the struggle over the treaty was one of the things that brought about his stroke. It was a tremendous battle. And I think it was in 1919 they had the stroke. It might have been 1920, but it had been late in the year. Probably 1920. I don't have the number, you know, the date right in front of me. But you're right. I mean, this is unlike today, where if that happened today, the 25th Amendment, where the president immediately signs over power to the vice president.
Vice president, yeah, right.
That wasn't in place, and instead his wife basically ran the country by acting as his gatekeeper. You know, if you wanted to talk to the president, you had to basically put it in writing, give it to her, so you'd take it into his bedroom, where only his doctor was allowed,
right,
than her. And apparently her and the doctor were in collusion.
Yeah, I mean, it's a fascinating story, something that has puzzled historians for a long time, because this lady, First Lady, in many ways, she would say, sign here, sign there, and he was in no condition very often to do much anything else but sign. But
right.
An interesting character. One thing about Woodrow Wilson, too, I just wanted to say before we go back to our story. Woodrow Wilson, at least Obama, Obama could argue that he got the majority of the popular vote both times, 52-something in 2008, and just slightly, somewhere between 50 and 51%. In 2012, not as much, but he was over 50%. But Woodrow Wilson never got that. Woodrow Wilson was always elected, somewhat like Clinton in a sense, with 40% of the vote or something like that in a three-way race. And when you win and you get 42, 43, 44% of the vote, you better make coalitions, because you won, but you still have a majority of the country that didn't vote for you. So you better make some coalitions and be smart if you want to get anything done. And I think that was Woodrow Wilson's mistake. He was maybe too vain or too arrogant to realize that half of the country didn't vote for him, and actually more than half didn't vote for him both times. And, Clinton was smart in that sense. He understood that, and he made deals with Republicans. Wilson wasn't. Just a quick historical point there about Woodrow Wilson and his presidency, that of course it was 1912 to 1920 was his presidency, the war being a big part of it, Barry.
Well, I think it's a very important part, and that's why he didn't get the Treaty of Versailles passed. Plus, you know, there's always been a very deep anti-interventionist, isolationist streak in the American character. George Washington famously warned America not to get involved with foreign entanglements, as he called them. He was speaking directly about wars in Europe, where the European powers were constantly going to war against each other. So that sentiment lasted as long as there has been a United States. And at the end of World War I, which, by the way, Wilson had sold that as a war to end all wars. He was able to get the anti-war crowd on board, the anti-war Democrats and Republicans on board, by billing it as a sort of a crusade in which America would be right. In fact, he crowed after the Treaty of Versailles was signed that at last the world is aware that America is a force of goodness in the world. He was really a moral crusader in many ways. But that said, the treaty was doomed by the time it got back without any Republican support. And there was a group in the Republican Senate called the Irreconcilables who just refused steadfastly to entertain the idea. And so with him having a stroke, not being able to fight for the League of Nations, America's signed that treaty. And by the way, the League of Nations was a precursor to the United Nations that grew out of the Treaty of Versailles. And the idea was that there would be this policing agency comprised of the victorious powers that would keep future aggression from happening. And if it did happen, they would jump all over the aggressor. This was put to the test in the 1930s when the League was finally tested. And by the way, the League was comprised mostly of France and Britain, They're the only ones with any muscle. And Italy tested them in Ethiopia, when they invaded Ethiopia in the 1930s.
One quick thing I wanted to say, nothing. Just for the benefit of some of the listeners, because it took me a while to figure this out, when I was reading about World War I, Versailles is actually a city in France. And that's where the actual, that's why it's called the Treaty of Versailles. It was a city, right, in France.
Palace.
Where a palace, okay, there you go.
It actually was a palace. The Palace of Versailles was the ancient palace of the French kings, built by Louis XIV, and it's where the famous Hall of Mirrors is, one of the most spectacular Baroque and Rococo structures probably in the world.
Hmm.
And if you want to see true opulence, any movie that has to do with the French Revolution, you'll probably see something that is either filmed at Versailles or is meant to look like Versailles.
But that was another mistake. But that was another mistake that the Allies made, to bring the Germans to such an obvious French place. You know, they could have done the signing or in an office in Paris, but by doing it in that palace, it simply stuck the needle even more. You know.
What's interesting about that is that the king that built that palace was Louis XIV, as I just said, and he is the French monarch that actually conquered Alsace-Lorraine. Which we've been mentioning all throughout this very series, six parts of the series, as one of the causes of the war. It was the fighting of Germany over Alsace-Lorraine in 1870 that eventually led to World War One, and of course now with French victory, they got back Alsace-Lorraine. But that originally been conquered by the French King Louis XIV from Germany, from the Holy Roman Empire. And so, yeah, you're right. It's sort of a stick in the eye by signing it in the very palace of the king who took Alsace-Lorraine from Germany in the first place.
Right, right. Yeah, it was just another example of sticking it to the Germans, I guess.
Well, what's so amazing about Europeans, and you saw this just this week with the Scottish independence vote, is that, I've been talking on Facebook with a lot of my English and Scottish friends, and I'm hearing other Europeans weigh in. And by the way, if you ever go to YouTube and you see the same phenomenon I'm about to describe.
If you go to YouTube and play some old European nationalistic music on YouTube, some French or German marching song, for instance, from the 18th century, Europeans hold grudges like Americans can't even imagine. When Scottish independence was being discussed up until a couple days ago, they're bringing back, the time of Braveheart. They're talking about grudges dating back to the Middle Ages.
Right.
It's just amazing. The Europeans hold on to grudges like you would not believe.
Well, they've been around a little bit longer, Barry. I think that's maybe why, I mean, because I have to laugh about this for a second because, I remember one time somebody, I was talking to a guy from Spain, and he was saying, my great-grandfather fought in that war. I mean, going back to the 1700s or something. And I said to myself, the only grudge that we have is between the North and the South. And that was 150 years ago. These people were fighting a lot longer than we've been around, Barry. Maybe that's where these grudges come from.
Well, yeah. I mean, I guess I shouldn't be too surprised because it seems to be human nature. In the Middle East, they still have grudges dating back to basically Cain and Abel, essentially. I remember when I was a young busboy in the 1970s at a restaurant, one of the chefs was German. And I was always a student of history, and he was a student, I guess, of European history to some extent. And we would occasionally chat, and he was an old guy. And when we talked about Germany, and somehow the subject of Sweden came up, and he snorted and started growling about Gustav Adolphus and how brutal and bloody his march to Germany was, and how the Swedes had devastated Germany during the 30 Years' War. The 30 Years' War took place in the 17th century, and this German was still holding a grudge against the Swedes.
Well, yeah, I mean, he probably heard about it every day that he was having dinner with his family,
That's amazing. Just amazing. Well, are we ready to move on here?
Absolutely. I think we want to get to the Middle East. I think.
We do. And the best way to think of to get into the Middle East is, let's quickly touch on casualties because it'll get us right there. The war claimed about 10 million soldiers and about another, when you add in casualties among civilians, about 39 total million people died in World War I. As a percentage of the population, Germany and France lost about 4% of their population. Most other powers lost less than that, with the exception of the Ottoman Empire. The Turks lost an incredible 13 to 15% of the population in that war, which is by a magnitude of, you know, 4 times what Germany lost. The Ottoman Empire was really ravaged, and it broke apart. As I've already mentioned, Armenia became a separate country. The British and the French took over the Middle East. Our Greece was getting ready to go to war against it. And in fact, in 1920, Greece and Armenia, the new country of Armenia, drawn up by Wilson, ganged up on Turkey and tried to take advantage of its weakness. But Turkey was led by a guy named Atatürk, Kemal Mustafa. He was the George Washington of the modern Turkish state, the republic that was replacing the old empire. And he created a modern democracy, which lasted till today. And he defeated both the Greeks, and he defeated the Armenians, and he drove the Greeks out of Asia Minor, Anatolia, and now the Aegean Islands that bordered Turkey. And a lot of them came to Athens. Athens became a huge city because of that. And a lot of Greeks came to America at that point, being driven out of their homes by the Turks. And in Armenia, you saw a genocide, the first genocide in the modern age, even preceding the Holocaust, in which the Turks killed the Armenians in the millions for revenge and to crush this new Armenian state that we had created. Meanwhile, to the south of Turkey, in Middle East, what had been the Turkish possessions were now given to the British and to the French, according to an agreement that was made in 1916. It's called the Sykes-Picot Agreement, or Picot, the French. The French diplomat was a man named François-Georges Picot, and he was, by the way, the great-uncle of Valéry Giscard d'Estaing, the former prime minister of France, the president of France, a couple decades ago. So Picot and Sykes drew up a map of the Middle East, basically doodling it on a probably on a napkin, and that became the basis for who would rule what part, the British or the French. The French basically got Syria and Lebanon and the area of northern Iraq. The British got pretty much the rest, and Saudi Arabia, which in those days was called the Hejaz, became a separate country and was soon be taken over by the House of Saud. In their territories, the British took provinces which had been nothing but territories of the Ottoman Empire, never been kingdoms of their own, they've been provinces, and created kingdoms and rewarded Arab sheiks and kings that had fought with Lawrence of Arabia, particularly Prince Faisal and Abdullah, and made them the kings of Iraq and Jordan, respectively. And by the way, the term Jordan had never been a kingdom, never been a territory before. That had never been used before in history. Jordan referred to before the kingdom of Jordan was created. It referred to the River Jordan and nothing else. And so this kingdom was called Transjordan, meaning that it was on both sides of the Jordan River, including parts of eastern Palestine that would eventually become Israel. And Lebanon had always historically simply meant the mountains. It had nothing to do with a territory. That area had always been called the Levant. But the French took it over, and they called it Lebanon, and they were going to create a Christian enclave in the Middle East along the coast there. And for many decades after World War II, in fact, Lebanon was a French-speaking, mostly Christian nation that ended in the 1970s and 80s. And then one more thing played a huge part in Middle Eastern history that we're still feeling to this very day, and that was that a guy by the name of Balfour made a declaration. He was a member of the British Foreign Office,
And it was called the Balfour Declaration, and it basically outlined in very short declaration the British desire to create in Palestine a Jewish state. Now, the British inherited a problem from the Ottoman Turks, which was that there was this Jewish settlement, a Zionist settlement, that had been around since the 1890s. In fact, in the 1890s, the Jewish settlers from Eastern Europe and mostly Russia had come to the area and bought that land from the Ottoman authorities, the Ottoman Turks, because that area along the coast of what is today Israel was uninhabited, and it was basically salty swamps, salt marshes. And they reclaimed the land, which no one wanted, and they drained the marshes, and they built Tel Aviv, and occupied Haifa, and rebuilt that as a city, and other cities along the coast. And within a few decades, it became so prosperous that Arab Bedouins living on the interior, always hungry for water and looking for places they could settle down and grow something, brought their families, and they settled there in great numbers. In fact, soon outnumbered the Jews. And so when the British got there in the 1920s, the end of World War One, and took over this area as the British mandate, they had to deal with this problem of this large Jewish population surrounded by an even larger Arab population that was not very friendly towards them. In fact, there have been some riots in which Arabs have killed large numbers of Jews. So Lord Balfour's idea was to create a Jewish state and a Palestinian state. And by the way, the term Palestine didn't exist either. It was called the Arabs and the Jews. Palestine was a creation much later. Didn't really come into use of the term until the 1970s. But the Arabs living in Palestine, were going to be given an Arab state, aside from Jordan, which was already there to the east. That was the Balfour Declaration, and really laid the groundwork for what would eventually become the Jewish nation, Israel, which will come into birth at the end of World War II.
Right.
But the main problem. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, I was going to ask you a quick question about the Middle East. Obviously, we think of the Middle East today as energy, oil. Was that the case back then? I mean, were they thinking about its energy resources back then? I mean, the price of a barrel was $3 a barrel, so obviously it wasn't like it is now, but still, I'm just kind of curious.
No, you're absolutely right. The British were already aiding the various Arab potentates on the Arabian Peninsula for some years before World War One, and certainly after World War One. They made treaties with the House of Saud, which was a very militant Wahhabi influenced group of Arabs in the center of the peninsula, and eventually took over the entire peninsula for oil concessions. British Petroleum being the main one, the main company that was dealing in there. It was called Occidental Petroleum, and later became British Petroleum. And they also had concessions in the New Kingdom of Iraq, and one of the deals that were made with the House of Faisal, which became the kings of Iraq, was that the British would be allowed, of course, if they put him on the throne, to then extract oil. And some of the money would go back to the kingdom, but a lot of it would go, of course, into the pockets of the company itself. And this was sort of a tried and true method, in that oil companies all throughout Europe and America and the United States would go to these Arab countries, and we made these Arab oil sheiks quite wealthy by giving them technology and pumping the oil they could not extract themselves, and paying them a subsidy. And it made the sheiks very rich, even while their people were still living in tents and were basically Bedouins. That didn't change the style of life.
And we would see some of that in Iran, wouldn't be in right after the Second War, right? Because there was a coup that happened there in the early 50s, right? That it was, that put the Shah in power. So maybe we saw some of that there too.
Except the difference being that Persia, we didn't call it Iran yet, but Persia was a far more developed area and a far more urban society, or at least a settled society. It wasn't Bedouins. They weren't Arabs, they were Persians. And they weren't Bedouins. They weren't unsettled nomads in the way the Arabs had been up until this period. Of course, there always had been an Arab city-dwelling population in the cities, But a lot of these ruling families came from the Bedouins. They came from the warrior class that swept in and took over these areas during or just after World War One.
Yeah, interesting. Here's what we're going to do, Barry. We've got about 5 or 6 minutes in our show today, so let me just kind of give you that almost like the 2-minute warning in the NFL, and that way you can kind of program yourself for the rest of the show, and then, you know, obviously whatever we have to do, we'll do it Thursday night when Leslie joins us. But so with that in mind, in the next 5 minutes or so, why don't you take the next step, and we'll finish it the following Thursday night.
No, that's perfect. That 5 minutes should about round this up, because the main problem with the way the British and the French divided the Middle East, they took flags. They created flags for these new nations. And one thing you'll notice, by the way, is that almost all these Arab flags have three colors in them. They have black, white, and green. These were designed by Sykes, Sir Mark Sykes of the Sykes-Picot Agreement. He basically was doodling, and he came up with three different colors that dated back to the ancient flags of three of the most powerful Arab empires of the Middle Ages, the Umayyads, which was green, the Fatimids of Egypt, which was black, and the Hashemites, which were red. And he put them into various configurations and various shapes and created these various flags, and these became the flags of Iraq and Syria, Jordan, Egypt. And what's interesting about that to me is that I was once with an Egyptian officer, and he once said to me, when looking at a map of the Middle East, he once said scornfully, you know, talking about the Arabs, he said, "They're nothing but tribes with flags. Only Egypt is a really true nation. The rest are just tribes with flags." And that's so true. Egypt had always been a nation and remained a nation even before World War One. But the rest of those creations were simply tribes brought together, and their borders were drawn arbitrarily. And the borders crossed tribal lines, they crossed religious lines. You have a lot of different, as we know today, there's a lot of complex ethnic and religious and sub-religious groups throughout the Middle East. There are the Druze, there are the Alawites, there's the Sunnis, the Shia, the Yazidis, the Chaldeans, Circassians, Assyrians, Turkomans, all these different groups. And by making arbitrary borders that incorporated some into one country and part of another group into another country, an example being the Kurds, there are Kurds living in three different countries now because the map didn't take into account the fact there was a single Kurdish identity, and instead put part of the Kurdish territory in Iran, part of it into Iraq, and part of it into the Druze ended up partially in Lebanon, partially in Syria, and partially in Turkey. And none of those people were very happy about it, and they certainly didn't have any loyalty. Iraq was a total creation. The Shiites dominated the south, the Sunni Arabs in the north, and the Kurds to the northeast. And when they were made into one nation, the only thing that held it together was force. And once the European powers left, those kingdoms, those kings that they left, had to contend with that. And some did. In the case of Jordan, some were successful. Jordan was more homogenous. Had Palestinian and Arab population, but didn't have four or five different populations or ethnic groups. But we see in Iraq there's constant problems. We see in Syria revolution. The king of Iraq was eventually overthrown. The king of Syria was overthrown. Egypt was overthrown, all by military coups. And it's always a case of one minority dominating the next whenever it has power. Tripoli or Libya, for instance, is a creation that was created this period out of Tripolitania and Cyrenaica brought together to form a nation called Libya, which hadn't existed under that name since the Roman Empire. That was a name the Romans had given it. So these were all very arbitrary, and we see today, this very day, the echo of World War One, the most profound echo of World War One, is the turmoil in the Middle East, where these nations in the so-called Arab Spring are really busting loose their bounds. They were that bound them together after World War One, imposed by the Europeans. And you see with ISIS, something that's much more indigenous, much more homegrown and organic. As much as I despise that movement, it's getting traction. It's gaining traction among the Arabs because it harkens back to a much more natural state, which is the only thing unifying those people is religion. And by calling for a caliphate, which is a religious leadership, a theocracy, and in fact, caliphates have existed over ruling over the Arabs since Muhammad in the 7th century, and particularly because he's centered in Iraq, where the old Abbasid caliphate of Baghdad used to exist. Al-Baghdadi, the new caliph, the so-called caliph of ISIS, is finding a lot of willing recruits, and he's getting a lot of psychological traction in the Arab world by erasing those borders created by the Europeans after World War I and creating a more indigenous and historically natural Arab nation in the form of a caliphate.
Yeah. And that's one of the consequences. I'm not saying directly consequences, but a combination of those things we're still living with today, Barry. I mean, the maps, the boundaries, that countries that we know today that didn't exist 120 years ago before World War I.
And in some cases, such as Libya, hadn't existed since the Roman Empire.
Right. Interesting. So how did they get these names? If I could just quickly ask you, like the word Libya, how did that name happen? Was it called Libya during the days of the Romans too?
Well, that's when it was called Libya. It was never called Libya any other time. Libya was basically a geographical name rather than a national name. It denoted not a country but a territory,
mm-hmm.
Much the way that Anatolia means area that's now modern Turkey. Or North America means the area that's now occupied by the United States and Canada.
Right.
And Libya just meant that section of North Africa.
There was a
right
region.
It was made up of two regions, the Tripolitania, which was the center around Tripoli, and then where Benghazi is Cyrenaica, where Benghazi and Cyrenaica and Tobruk are. And those were incorporated into one area and given to Italy, which that became, you know, the basis of Mussolini's Italian Empire.
Hmm. Well, let's do this, Barry. Let's take about 30 seconds and talk about next week. Leslie's joining us to talk about the Spanish flu, I believe. So when we get together next week, what will we be wrapping up?
Well, we're pretty much done with World War One in the aftermath.
Right.
Let's spend a little bit of time before we get into the Spanish flu. We'll talk about the rise of radicalism and set the stage for the 1930s, which was when Hitler, Mussolini, and Stalin really come to the fore, and how that relates to World War One and how these guys got to power. We've already talked a little bit about Hitler, but we'll finish up that story which we just began. And we'll talk about Mussolini, who ruled out this period, as well as Joseph Stalin.
Right. And we'll talk about the United States also and how the United States was basically out of the game for much of the 20s and 30s, completely out of the game, completely isolated from the world. And that was the way the country wanted it. I mean, it wasn't. It was very tough for Roosevelt to get the country interested in the war. It took Pearl Harbor to do it. But for much of the 20s and 30s, as the world was falling apart, the United States was very much isolated. Americans did not want to get involved. Maybe it was the bitter memory of World War One. Maybe we'll get into that as well next week. But, Barry, thank you so much, as always, for your great contribution, great input. I thought it was a great show. And we'll get together the next time, and I'm glad you're feeling better.
Well, thank you, and I should be really tip-top in time to spar with Leslie a little bit. She's always a feisty addition to the discussion.
Well, you know, we'll be talking about Egypt next week with Leslie around.
Yeah, somehow I'm really curious to see how Leslie's going to work Egypt into a discussion of the Spanish flu, but I'm sure she
can.
Well,
that's what I'm anxious to see the same thing. She always does. So we're sitting here speculating how she's going to do that. But anyway, I'm sure she'll manage it. I'm sure she'll manage it. She's pretty talented at that.
She always does. Yes, she does.
She always does. All right, Barry. Have a great Saturday, and thank you so much for joining us. It was absolutely great.
The pleasure was all mine, as always. Take care.
Thank you very much. And Barry was saying, we'll be talking about the Spanish flu the next time. And Leslie's going to be joining us. We'll be talking a little bit more about what happened in the 20s and 30s. And as long as we're talking about the Spanish flu, well, let's leave you with a little flamenco. This is Silvio Canto in Dallas.